Thank you. My name is Keith Lewis. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Oh, it's so nice to be here. I'm so grateful to be asked. Aretha called me, and I've been anxious to get here. You know, my daughter goes to school just up the road at Auburn, and that makes half the people happy. And I was hoping I'd get to see some of my dear friends from Birmingham. I lived in Birmingham for a couple years, about 5 years ago, and they're here, and that really thrills me. And being with Gene and Bill, Sue and Wade has just been wonderful. And Bill didn't say anything, but he and Gene are celebrating 44 years of marital bliss today. There's a special place in heaven for Gene. He couldn't have talked this much for 44 years, did he? Never shuts up. Just never. I'm just kidding. I've had a wonderful time. I really have. It's just so good to be here. It's so good to be in Florida with you at this time in my life. If you're kind of new to Alcoholics Anonymous, what we do is what we've done this weekend, and I'm so grateful to the speakers that I've heard sharing and some that I hadn't met before, and I'm awfully glad to meet, and some who I've known for a while and glad to see again. But what we kind of do is we talk a little bit about what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now. And there's something about doing that that does those of us up here a lot of good. And my prayer, my fervent prayer, is that it might do you a little bit of good too. I bring you greetings from my home group, the little group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Fayetteville, North Carolina. And we meet Monday night at Alpine or a Baptist Church, and please come and see us if you're ever in Fayetteville. It's a wonderful little group, and they pray for me when I go away. I talked to my wife just before I came down here, and she prays for me when I'm talking, and I'm so grateful for that, just as I'm grateful for you. You know, it wasn't always like this. I was thinking, you know, today we were riding around and looking at the beautiful scenery and meeting all the nice people, and it wasn't always like this. And for a guy like me, there was never a hope or a chance that it would be like this. I was born in the Ohio Valley, a little town called Martins Ferry, and I was the second child and the oldest son in a family of 11 children. I'm Irish. And I won't tell you what church I went to. I'm going to make you guess. I'll give you a hint. It has something to do with bingo. And you know, I was reading some scripture, and I read that part where it said we're wonderfully made. And I always think that I wasn't wonderfully made. I was made different. And the difference between me and the other people around me were that when God made me, he made all my nerves on the outside. And everybody else's nerves were on the inside. So I was an extremely sensitive child. And I recognized things. One of the first things I recognized was how unfair it all was. And I also recognized that the people in the world didn't worry enough. And so I worried for them. And I made a lot of observations. I observed that I saw things other people didn't see. I was the first one in my home to discover that there was something under my bed. Nobody else noticed those things, but I did. And it was only there when the lights were out. And I could lay there at night and press my little ear against the mattress, and I could hear it moving around down there. And I knew what it was there for. It was there waiting for me to dangle my little legs over the side of the bed, and I was gone. I was just history. I just wouldn't exist anymore. And then after a while, I noticed one morning that it began to reach up over the sides of the bed. And because I'd look at the sheets, and they'd have marks on them. And I knew that now it was reaching up for me. And I kept this a secret. I didn't tell anybody. I waited for them to talk about it. From the time I was a real little kid, I had an old idea about the world, and it was sort of this, that everybody in the world knew what was going on but me. it was like God took everybody and put him in a room, something like this. And he said, he got up at the podium and he said, listen, he said, pay attention now. I said, I'm going to go through this one time, and I want you to pay attention and get this. And he told everybody about everything. He told the girls about boys and the boys about girls. He told people how to grow up and what it was like to be a real man. And I was in the bathroom. And I kind of had the feeling as I went through life that you knew what was going on and I didn't. And my job was to sort of watch you and then to figure out what the answer was. And you know, it wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous I found out that you didn't know what the hell was going on either. And that was one of the best pieces of information I got. And the other thing that I remember about being a little kid was my first drink. And I never forget this as long as I live. And I like to talk about this. I have a number of brothers, but the brother I'm closest to in age is my brother Denny. And Denny's a year younger than I am, and he's just dumb as a box of rocks. You probably have a brother like that. Most everybody does. And just dumb. And we drank together for the first time, and my father was watching us, and we were around the kitchen table, and we were playing bug or some kind of game, and I guess my father thought it might be kind of funny. I was 5, and Denny was 4, and my mother was out. I don't know if she's either bingo or having a baby or something. And I guess Dad thought it'd be kind of cute, and he got us all a beer. It was rarely beer around our house, but he got himself a beer, and he got one for me and one for dumb Denny. And he gave us these little glasses, you know, the kind with the jelly glasses used to have the cartoon characters on them. And mine had Superman on it. I don't know if that's significant. A psychologist would probably think so. But we drank our beer, and I was fine. I was fine. But old Denny is having a bad time. He sort of slid down out of the chair, and he's rolling around under the table, and he was singing Mary Had a Little Lamb and other drinking songs. And my father kind of panicked and he wrestled him to the ground. He took his clothes off and he put his jammies on him, you know, the kind with the feet and the trap door and everything. But I was fine. And I got up and got ready for bed. And Denny was singing and carrying on and laughing and having the best time. And my father took him upstairs and put him in his little crib. And he's kicking and screaming and carrying on, singing and everything. And I went up and I got into bed, and my dad said, look, whatever you do, don't tell your mother about this. If you don't tell your mother about this, he said, I'll take you to the movies. And I figured, well, I'm easy to get along with, and I agreed, but Den wasn't hearing it. He's just having the best time. And I'll never forget this. Old Denny stood up in his crib and he urinated on the floor. I'll never forget that. And I'm laying over my bed watching this disgusting display. And I remember what I was thinking, you know. Now there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. Never forget that. And the saddest thing happened to Denny. It's just the saddest thing. He just never made it. You know, he's one of those kids with all that potential. And he just never made it. He just grew up and got weird. He did strange stuff, like he went to one college and he graduated on time, and he had one major, you know, and he went to one graduate school and graduated on time. He went to work for one company. He's a vice president of a large international corporation now, and the most disgusting thing of all, he's married to one woman. And figure, here's a kid who had the world in the palm of his hand when he was 4 years old, and he just let it slip through his fingers. Huh? I was 22 years old before I urinated on a bedroom floor. Just don't understand him. He's just a strange kid. You know, I was 17 years old and I graduated from high school, and we were, you know, didn't have a lot of money, and I had no idea what I wanted to do. And so, I knew that I had to go to the military. And so I took one of my very first inventories. I didn't often inventory myself because, quite frankly, I didn't want to know. But I stood in front of the mirror and I took my shirt off and I stood there and I sized myself up. And I was 5'1" tall and I weighed 113 pounds and I looked into my eyes and I could see I was just a born killer. So I joined the Marine Corps. And I'll never forget, my mother had to sign for me to join, and she was crying and everything, and she signed a paper, and that night before I left, I'll never forget, oh, Mom was just having a bad time, she's crying and everything, and I could hear my father talking to her. He said, "Don't worry, Pat, they'll send them back. They won't take them," and so the next day I got on a bus in Wheeling, West Virginia, and I went to Pittsburgh. Now, that's about as far as I'd ever been from home in my life. It was about 60 miles, and I'd gone to Cleveland once, but the game was rained out. But I went up to Pittsburgh, and it was 1961. It was a real bad year, and they took whatever came through, and there were four of us, and three guys from Pittsburgh and myself, and we were sworn in. So in July 1961, I was sworn in the Marine Corps, and that night we're finished about 4 o'clock and the train left at midnight. And a fellow said, "Well, we're going to go over and have a sandwich and a beer. Would you like to join us?" And I figured, well, what do I know? I'm from out of town. And so I tagged along and we went over there and I was just terrified. I don't know if you were the kind of alcoholic I was, but I was afraid my whole life. I just lived in a constant state of anxiety and a constant state of fear. Nothing I ever did was good enough. I was never smart enough. I always missed the mark. I hadn't seen a ball since the kickoff. You know, one of those people. And I followed these guys in this bar. And I don't know if you've ever been in a bar in Pittsburgh, but they have real men in Pittsburgh. You know, the kind with tattoos and they spit on the floor and they knew names of stuff I couldn't even imagine doing. Every one of them had a real woman with them. Real women are women who hang around with real men, and guys like me get what's left. And I follow these guys into the bar, and I just sort of sat back in the corner and tried to be anonymous. And a bartender came over. He's a real man. And he said, "What do you want?" And I remember how it frightened me, because, you know, I thought life was a pop quiz. I thought that when you least expected it, somebody like a nun or something was going to say, "Take out a blank sheet of paper and put your name in the upper left-hand corner, and we're going to have a test." And I hadn't studied the night before. And that's how I felt about life. And this bartender came over and said, "What do you want?" So quickly I watched the other guys, and they all ordered a beer, so did I. And I drank it, and nothing happened. But the bartender came back, and he asked again. And I did. They ordered a beer, and I did too. And then he came back, and I ordered another one. And then it happened. And if you're alcoholic, you know what happened. I don't have to explain it to you. My whole life changed. I had a profound spiritual experience in Pittsburgh in a bar. And I never forget as long as I live. You know, I stood up. I don't even think I meant to stand up. I don't think I could have kept from standing up. And I looked down, and the floor was 6'4" below me. And I looked out here, and my right shoulder was out to here, and my left shoulder was out to there, and the muscles were rippling through my body. It's incredible. But the thing that was most amazing to me was my mind. That mind that had been filled with fear and doubt and anxiety was clear. And for the very first time in my life, I saw the big picture. I really, for the first time, understood all about life. I knew about women. I knew about men. I knew about growing up. I knew about being a real man. I knew about God. I knew about the Marine Corps. I knew everything. And then I looked up and my heart broke. I looked around this room and it was filled with these pathetic, smiddling little men. They all had women with them who were looking at me with hungry eyes. You know how they do. And they were thinking, "God, I'd give anything if I could have a man like that." And I went to take a step and I stumbled. And one of the guys said, "What's the matter?" I said, "I don't know. I think I just tripped over an invisible line." And I think I did. I think that's the day that I entered into alcoholism. Now, I got a lot sicker than that. But I don't believe I ever got any more alcoholic than that. Because that's the day I discovered that alcohol was the solution to my problem. And I really did. I got a lot sicker in the intervening years. But I really don't believe I ever got any more alcoholic. And my sponsor's Tom Ine. He's always right, except when we disagree. And Tom and I will frequently get into a discussion about, well, whether or not there was a time that you could have quit drinking. And he said, you know, you could have quit drinking. And I said, who would want to? I mean, I would rather feel the way I felt that day than any day that I'd ever lived in my entire life. Maybe I could have quit drinking, but who would want to? I mean, they got places for guys who would want to go back to being the way I was. And they wear wraparound sport coats and stuff. And you know, I drank that day, and I drank till the train left. And I went down to the and got on that train to go off to be a Marine. I was going to Parris Island, South Carolina, and I knew all about the Marine Corps. And the train pulled into Washington, D.C., and I came to, and I'd fallen asleep on the floor of the Pullman coach that they gave me, and someone had wet the floor of the Pullman coach, and I got up, and I got changed clothes, and I looked at myself, and I was little and skinny and afraid again. And the guy said, look, we're going to go over to the Monaco and have a few beers. Why don't you join us? And I said, of course, what do I know? I'm from out of town. And I followed him over there, and the same thing happened. And that night, I fell off the train in Yamasee, South Carolina. That's where they come to collect the Marine recruits that are going to Parris Island. And I didn't mean to fall, but somebody moved the bottom step, and I fell across the railroad tracks. And there was a very rude man there, and call him a drill instructor. And he was hurling obscenities at me and these other young men who had gone to die for our country. And I got up and I tried to explain to this cretin that he would probably get a lot further if he treated us nice. I never did convince him, but we found out how many push-ups I could do drunk, I'll tell you that. I could do a lot of push-ups drunk when some cretin's screaming at you and threatening your life and making accusations about my family that were absolutely groundless. I could tell you that. I was shocked. And so I was launched into my career as a Marine. And I must say, I loved the Marine Corps. I really did. Next to the nuns, it was easy. I just loved it. There's something about it. I liked everything about it. I liked the bad times and the good times. And I got off of Parris Island with Dress Blues Award and Outstanding Man's Award. I mean, I just loved it. Being a little man in the Marine Corps is a real advantage because most of the drill instructors are big guys, and they all think if you're little, you can't do anything. So if you can, you're way ahead. And I went off and went to division and got a lot of promotions and worked hard and all that. I just loved the Marine Corps. And I decided I was going to stay for 150 years or longer if they'd have me. It's just really the way I felt about it. And, you know, within 4 years, I'd violated every principle that was important to me in the Marine Corps. And at the very end, I had led a patrol in combat in blackout. I had done things that were absolutely insane, and I never got busted. I was good enough that they always let me go. And at the very end, after 4 years, I got out. And I got out because I was blaming the Marine Corps for the way things were. And, you know, I got sober about 8 years after that, somebody said to me, you ever lose a job? I said, certainly not. You know, I lost the first one that meant anything to me. I had worked hard to get a commission, and I was given an appointment to go to Quantico to go to Officers Candidate School, and I hung it on a nail and got out. And I went to work in a steel mill, and that lasted about 3 months. And they're really picky about coming in, you know. And my brother was an engineer there, not Dumb Denny, another dumb brother I have, and I knew that my behavior was beginning to reflect on him, and so I left there and I went off to Maryland and went to school, just did a variety of things. But most of all, what I did was progress in my alcoholism. And during this time of my drinking is when I just became angry. And it was an amazing thing. And I remember, as an angry kid, I began to try to find God. And I did a lot of strange things. I spent some time at a place called Woodstock College, which is a Jesuit theologian in Woodstock, Maryland. And I went to work there so I could live there, and I hung around all these guys. This is where the Jesuits from that province, the Baltimore province, or Maryland province, do their theology training. And golly, I met a lot of holy men. And, And I thought that if I could get around these holy people or be around a holy place, that somehow I'd learn a little more about God. And I remember toward the end of my, I spent a couple of years there, and toward the end of my time there, I was walking around this college, and I met an extremely, extremely famous and holy theologian. Man, had just come back from Rome. And I was walking around, and by this time I'm about 6 years into my alcoholism, and by this time I'm really angry and just constantly thinking. I couldn't shut my head off. And I remember as Father Murray said to me, he looked at me and smiled. He was walking around, I was walking the other way, and he said, "Oh, son," he said, "I see you're just out here contemplating the existence of God." And I remember screaming at him. And I said, "You know, God doesn't, there isn't a God. If he is, he doesn't want to be in my, involved in my life. He's in Mexico or someplace." And I remember he looked at me, he was very sad. He said, "What you tell me is that you're an agnostic." And he said, "Look," he said, "if you don't mind some advice," he said, "don't be an agnostic." He said, "If you want to be an atheist, that's fine." He said, "But don't hang around places like this. If you're an atheist, places like this aren't any fun." And he said, if you decide to be an atheist, he said, "go out and live whatever you got, because that's all there is." And he said, "And if you decide to be a believer," he said, "that's wonderful, because you'll live with peace and contentment and serenity. You'll know purpose, and you'll know reason. And most importantly, you'll know God." He said, "But don't do yourself the disservice of being an agnostic, because then you're saying you can't know the most important thing in your life, and that's your relationship to God." And I remember how enraged I was at this man, and how I just stormed away from him. And you know, 8 years later, 7 years later, I was sober and went back and got a degree in theology. And I remember reading this man's work. And I thought by then how true that is. That if there's anything in the world for me to know, it's my relationship to God. And what I didn't understand then, though, was that the only way I can have that is with you. See, that's what AA taught me. You know, and I left that college and I went to Washington, D.C. and took a job and met an unfortunate young woman. And one thing led to another, and I was married. And I was married and very, very alcoholic. And we know how it is. It was absolutely crazy. It was insane. You know, my alcoholism was so virulent and so incredibly rapid that it just destroyed everything around me. I was married to this woman who, to the best of my knowledge, I loved very, very much. And I know she loved me. And we both just went absolutely insane. I was one of these people who became more and more jealous and followed her around and watched her with binoculars. And she worked in a hospital across the street from where we lived. And I used to watch her leave at night. And I'd watch to see who she was talking to, because that's the man she was having an affair with. And she got so crazy that she would wait inside a door till a group of women came, and she'd rush out with them. And it was that sort of insanity that went on. And we had 2 children in less than a year. And the second one was born about 2.5 months premature, and she weighed about 1.5 pounds. Nobody expected her to live. And by this time, I'd just utterly, completely given up on any notion of a God or anything else. And I was directing some laboratories at Georgetown University Hospital, and she was born at Georgetown University Hospital. And she was born the day after they got an experimental machine called a negative respirator, and she had hyaline membrane disease. And they didn't think she had a chance, but since I worked in the hospital, they said that they would try her on this machine. And the doctor came and talked to me and said, "Don't hold out any hope that she'll live." And he said, "If she lives, she'll certainly be retarded." And I was just numb. I remember our office was across from the neonatal nursery, and I remember sitting in there at night with the lights out and the door slightly ajar, watching this kid fight for a life. And I remember that what they try to get the parents to do is to come in and take part with this child's struggle. And they would want the parents to come in and hold the baby or to touch the baby and things like that. And I remember how terrified I was of this kid, because I knew that if I loved this kid the way I was afraid I would, that God would take her. because I had long since figured out that if God found out I liked something, He took it. And I remember the night that I watched my wife, who by this time is like she's battle weary. She was walking around with this 1,000-yard stare that we see in men who are shell shocked, and she walked down the hall one night and just walked into the nursery, and she took some water and went over and baptized Kimberly because we didn't think she'd live through the night. And I remember sitting in that office, and all I wanted to do was the ability to rush in there and put my arms around both of them and say, we can do this together, we can pull together, but I couldn't. So I did the only thing I knew how to do, and that was to get angrier with God and angry with them because of what they were putting me through. And I hated myself. I constantly lived at this time with the thought of killing myself. And you know, fortunately, there's a French philosopher and mathematician named Blaise Pascal, and he said something that really impressed me. He said that God created man in His own image, and unfortunately, man returned a favor. And when I got to you, I discovered that was true, that I had created a God in my own image, an angry, vengeful God. And that's the God I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's why I'm glad you told me not to think too much about God in the beginning. And I said, well, why not? You all seem to think He's important. And you told me in a very gentle way, yeah, but you're wrong about Him too. So don't think much about it. And for me, that was good advice. But I was in an absolute rage at God. And I got to tell you, that child lived. And she's now an honor student and a junior in education at Auburn University. And she's incredibly gorgeous. I mean, a gorgeous child. And I have a friend who told me that he had a son who nearly died. And I said to him, I said, you know, Kimberly's different. And he said, yeah. He said, Ed's different too. And I said, why is that? And he said, I think they've talked to angels. And I think that's true. I think people who come close to dying talk to angels. And what I see in her is what I saw in you when I came here, because so many of you have been so close to dying that there's something special about you that attracts me to you. And we went home, and we took the baby home after many, many days and weeks, and my drinking just continued. And we'd have these crazy times, absolutely crazy times. I remember when we'd start over. I don't know if anybody here ever started over, but we were big at starting over. And the way we'd start over is we'd take the kids to either my mom's or her mom's, and we'd leave, and we'd come back. And she'd buy, tickets to the baseball game because I like that. And I'd run down to the Kennedy Center or someplace, and I'd buy tickets to the theater because she liked that stuff. And then she'd go out and buy a negligee or something, you know, that did strange things to me. And I'd promise to come right home from work. And it was great to start over. I'd come trotting home from work and we might have a drink or two, and we might have dinner on the balcony or something, and we'd go off to the ball game, or we'd go to the theater, and we'd come home, and she'd put one of those things on. It did funny things to me, and it's wonderful. And we'd do that for 3 or 4 days. And then one day I'd be driving home from work, and it would strike me how selfish I was. And I was thinking, I hadn't said anything to the guys in the bar about this, and they were all pulling for us to make this thing. And you know the story. I stopped by to tell them how well it was going, and I looked at the clock, and it was 10 o'clock, and I knew what was going to happen. You know, I'd go home, and she'd still be awake, and she'd be screaming at me and calling me names, all that were unjustified. And then I'd say things that I wouldn't want to say. And so for her, I stayed till 2. But then on the way home, I started thinking, and I said, you know, that girl's crazy about you. And you know, she just wants you all the time. Give her a break. So I decided to go home. But when I got there, it was strange. She didn't have that little negligee on. She had this thing on it. It looked like it started up here, you know, and it went to the ground. And it was brown, it's sort of formless, and it looked something like a buffalo robe. And she's angry, and I was suggesting to her that we might make love, and she was hurling these obscenities at me. I thought she had talked to that drill instructor. And I remember I just went crazy, and I tore the place up. I just threw things around, and I screamed and hollered, and, And she was seeing a psychiatrist, which explained part of why I was drinking the way I was. And he gave her some medicine. It did funny stuff to her eyes. I mean, one eye would look one way, and the other eye would look the other way. And you can't do that without some sort of an accident. And she got this strange look, and she grabbed her matching buffalo robe and house coat and put it on and grabbed her purse and ran out of the house. And I knew what she was going to do. She was going to go call this psychiatrist that she was having an affair with. She and the psychiatrist were having an affair. And they were trying to get rid of me. I mean, I knew. I wasn't born yesterday. And he was going to tell her to call the police. So I did what any good drunk would do. I ran around. I cleaned that apartment up. Boy, that looked better than when I got home. And I straightened everything up and everything. And I ran in and I took my clothes off. And I had pajamas her mother had given me. And I used to wear these pajamas when the police came. And I put my pajamas on and I put my robe on and I messed my hair up and a doorbell rang. And I went over and I looked out through the little peephole. And outside was my wife wrapped up in her buffalo robe. She was crying. And she was with two Prince George's County policemen. There was a fellow, young fellow about 21 and an old guy about 30. And I gathered myself together and I pulled the door open and I said, "Thank God you found her." And she had that, "Oh no, I've been had again," Al-Anon look, you know, pre-Al-Anon looking. So we came in the apartment, and the policeman looked around, and you know, they were expecting to find this place all torn up, and it looked great. But you can't be too careful when you're dealing with the police. So I said to her, "Honey, did you call the doctor?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, thank God, if you have to run out of here in the middle of the night, at least you called the doctor." And you know, she burst into tears, and she ran back in the bedroom. The older of the two policemen sort of reached over and hit me on his shoulder, and he said, "You hang in there, son." I said, "Yes, sir." And they laughed. And you know, I was sad about that. And, you know, we laugh now. She laughs. She's happily remarried. I tell you, she did a lot better the second time. She really did. My husband-in-law is a great guy, and we all get along. I'll tell you how well this program works. When Kimberly graduated from high school, Julia, my then fiancée, now my wife, Julia and myself were there. My ex-wife and her husband and his ex-wife. Now, if you don't think this... And we were all grateful. Now, if you don't think this program works, I got to tell you something. But you know what was sad was I went and made a drink. I mean, after, you know, something like that. And I made a drink and I got her a glass of wine and she got one of those pills And I went in, and she was sitting on a bed, and I think the deeper people are hurt, the bigger the tears. And she was crying these huge tears, and they were just sort of dripping down on a buffalo robe. And I gave her a glass of wine, and you know, she looked up at me, and she said, "Can you ever forgive me for embarrassing you like that?" And I said, "Honey, you don't mean to do that." I said, "You're having a hard time." And, you know, she took off the buffalo robe and put on that negligee, and we went to bed. And, you know, we were sure that we were the luckiest couple in the neighborhood. And we knew we were more in love than anybody else in the world. And that's alcoholism. And may I never, ever forget that. That's the kind of insanity in which I lived. And fortunately, she had some sane moments. And one day she said to me, "You must leave. You absolutely must leave." And I knew it was right. And I left. And that saved my life. I went to where I needed to go in order to get better, and that was to places that I didn't think I could get to, and I got there in 6 weeks or 6 months, and I ended up living in a dive in Skid Row section of Washington D.C. by the zoo, which was appropriate, and the last month or so I drank like I never knew you could drink. I was one of these people who always went to work. I was employee of the year at the university the year I got sober. And I mean, that's how I worked, but then it just all fell apart. And I drank like I never knew you could drink. And one day, it was just happened to be May the 13th, 1973. It wasn't anything different. It was just another day. And I woke up and I just knew that I couldn't live anymore. And it's an interesting sort of a thing. As I look back now, it really was a whimper and not a bang. It was just the next thing. I often think of what I paid, what my alcoholism cost me, and, You know what my alcoholism cost me was just the next thing. You know, somebody would say to me, I'd say, give me a beer. And a bartender would say, well, that's 15 cents in your Marine Corps career. And I'd say, well, of course. And I just paid it. And then one day, someone said to me, I said, you know, I need a bottle of vodka bad. And how much is it? And they said, well, it's $4 and your wife and two little girls. And I said, but of course. And I paid it. And then one day they said, I needed some wine. And I asked what it cost. And the man told me, he says, well, he said, it's 69 cents in your self-respect and your dignity. And I said, of course. And then one day I got up and price was my life. And I never ever asked. And, you know, it amazes me. Only a non-alcoholic could ask, how can a person do that to themselves? You can because that's what it costs. That's all. That's what it costs. And I went into the bathroom, fully intending to die. I was 29 years old. Fully intending to die. And I had enough pills in there to kill me and three other people. I worked around hospitals and my wife was a nurse and so they noticed I had a nervous condition. So everybody's always giving me pills and I was always afraid of them. So I never took them. A little girl told me one night that's the saddest story she ever heard, but I just never took them. I was afraid of them. And so I had this medicine cabinet full of pills. And you know, to this day, I don't know if I began to take them or not. I got them ready to take, and I may have taken some, I may not have, I don't know. But I had a thought, and you know, that day in Pittsburgh, between the second and third drink, my mind was perfectly clear, and it shocked me. It had never been like that before. And you know, that morning, May the 13th, 1973, in that bathroom, my mind for a second was perfectly clear. And I realized that I wasn't supposed to die. And I panicked because I didn't know what to do about living. And I ran out, and my ex-wife had given me two phone numbers. And she said, if you ever want to do something for yourself, call these. One, she told me later, was to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the other was to a treatment center. And I lost one of the numbers, and I called the other. It was that simple. And it happened to be the treatment center, and I am very grateful for that. I hear a lot of people slam treatment centers and put them down. I must tell you, I would not be alive had it not been for a treatment center. I needed to be someplace. I never would have made it. I know that. I know that as certain as I'm standing here. And I called, and a woman answered the phone, and there was something about her voice. She had a British accent, and that impressed me, but it was more than that. And I told her, it's short and sweet. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I didn't know what I was. And all I said to her was, if you don't take me, I think I'm going to die. And she could hear it in my voice, and she did what I now know is a trick. She said, would you please give me your phone number, and I'll call you right back. And what she wanted to do was get my phone number in case I hung up on her so she could notify the police. And I gave her the phone number, and I hung up, and I slid down on the floor, and I just began to cry. And I looked up, and it was a fifth of scotch on the draining board in this dive in which I was living. And if you're kind of new, I'd like to ask you, please, tonight, before you go to bed, take a look at your life and find out what it is that God's given you that's special. That He gives each and every one of us something that's very, very special when we begin this journey. And what He gave me was this notion. I knew that if I took one more drink of alcohol, I would die. More importantly, I knew that knowing that would never, ever keep me from taking it. To drink is to die, but to know that won't keep me from taking it. You know, I used to, at university hospitals, they post autopsies, sort of like coming attractions. You know, so if you're interested in something, you can go watch it. And I used to watch for chronic alcoholics. And when they'd autopsy a chronic alcoholic, I'd go and watch. Because I'd see them take out that liver and a brain and all that stuff. And I figured it would slow me down. You know, all it did was made me run down to Clyde's or Chadwick's and drink, you know. And then I'd wonder how anybody could do that to themselves. So I know I can't be scared sober. I know I can't. There's no way on God's green earth I'll be scared straight. Okay? And I ran over and grabbed that fifth and I started to pour it out. And I knew I couldn't. I knew I was utterly powerless over alcohol. I didn't know Alcoholics Anonymous existed. I didn't know the first step. I didn't know anything. But what I knew was that that stuff owned me, body, mind, and soul. and I threw the bottle in the sink, and if it had bounced, I don't think I'd be here. It broke. And the phone rang, and it was Dorothy. And she said, we'll take you Wednesday. And I didn't know what day that was. But a few days later, I got in a car, and I drove to that treatment center. And that night, they took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It took me 5 hours to drive 30 miles to that treatment center. I could go so far, and then I burst into tears. And I ended up wetting my pants, and I was horribly sick. And I got there, and a lady sat across from me, a recovering alcoholic sat across from me, a woman. And she looked me in the eye, and she said to me, you're not bad, you're just sick. And it was something inside of her that did something to me, much like Dorothy's voice had done. And I couldn't understand it. I was mystified by it. And I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that group, they had a greeter. And this man's job was to shake your hand and greet you. And I had no notion of what to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what you did. I didn't know anything about you. But this man stood at the door, and he shook my hand. I like to hug. I think hugs are nice. But I'd love to shake hands. Because this man shook my hand like he meant it, and he looked me in the eyes. God, I didn't want to be looked in the eyes, you know? Because I knew when I lived in Washington, my sponsor's name was Sandy, and I said to Sandy, why don't I like to look in people's eyes? And he says, you're afraid they'll look back and won't see anybody. And that's the truth. I was afraid somebody would look at me and say, there's nobody inside of that man. That's just the way I felt. And But he looked me in the eye and he shook my hand and he said, son, if you keep coming here, you never have to drink again. And I remember how strange I felt. And then I went on in, and the room was filled with old people. Well, you people are lucky. There are a lot of us young ones around now. But when I got here, the place was crawling with old people. You know? Let me tell you, I'm going to tell you a little bit about old timers, okay? Old-timers keep coming to meetings, but they don't need to. They don't. They don't need to come to meetings. They tell you they do, but they don't need to come to meetings. They only come to meetings for one thing, and that's to laugh at you. You don't believe me. You find an old-timer, and you tell them a problem, and see what they do. First thing they always do is laugh at you. Ho, 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 ho. Oh, your wife's leaving you. Ha, ha, ha. And the other thing they tell you is no sex. Always tell you no sex. They don't have any more sex. It's too late. And the only enjoyment they get out of life is watching you be miserable. Old lady was sitting there, about 10 days older than dirt, and she saw me, and she latched a hold of me, and she brought me over and set me down, and she went and got me a half a cup of coffee, and she came back, and she sat there and patted me. I'm thinking, I'm sequestered with an old pervert, and this meeting's going on, and I don't remember anything about the meeting except one word. I remember the word fellowship in the preamble. A fellowship of men and women. I remember how good that word sounded to me. Protestants use that word all the time, but Catholics don't use that word much. What a powerful word that was to me. Fellowship. And it felt warm, and this old chick's patting me and smiling at me and everything. And halfway through the meeting, she looked over at me, and her face exploded into this smile, and she said, Sonny, if you keep coming here, you never have to be alone again. And I burst into tears. I didn't know that what I was alone. I really didn't know that. And all my old ideas were there. And that's the hard part about getting sober. It's all those old ideas. This idea that if God found out I liked something, he'd take it away from me. What a horrible way to live, waiting for God to do something to you. And I didn't want God to know how much I wanted what you had. I spent all day waiting for the AA meeting. All day. I'd be anxious about it. I couldn't decide what to wear. I didn't want to overdress. Didn't want to underdress. You know? And I changed clothes 3 or 4 times. And then I was always afraid I wouldn't know where the meeting was. I had a lot of bad, thinking problems and a lot of brain trouble. I really did. And I'd forget things like where I was going and where the meeting was and what day it was. And frequently I'd drive from work to where the meeting was. And if I thought I couldn't get back, I'd stay there. And then I'd sit outside the meetings and I'd watch all you people arrive and I'd watch you greet one another and smile and everything. And my heart would just sort of start to pound. And I was just overwhelmed with you. And just a few minutes before the meeting had started, I'd stroll in looking nonchalant. And every once in a while you'd say something to me like, "How do you like AA?" And I'd say, "It's all right." And inside I was saying, "I love it, I love it." But I didn't want God to know how much I loved it because I was afraid He'd take it away from me. And I had all these old ideas, and one day it just sprung out of me. I was up, my first sponsor, Dan, was answering the phones up at Intergroup, and I used to have to report up there from 7 to 10 every Monday night. And I wasn't allowed to do anything but pace back and forth and complain. And he talked to the drunks. And one day I watched this man, and he's on the phone with a woman who was drunk, and she's inviting him over to sleep with her. And he was saying, "No, ma'am, we don't do that in Alcoholics Anonymous, but what I can do is have a couple ladies come by and talk to you." And it struck me that this man was sharing love with another human being, and she'd never know who he was. And he'd never get any credit for it. And it exploded another old idea. You see, I always thought that I lived in a world that was filled with shortages. You know, my parents had a lot of children, and if they loved any of my brothers or sisters more than me, that meant I got less. And my children were open and loving, and they loved everybody they met, and I hated that because I thought it meant that they loved me less. And I thought that there was only so much respect, there's only so much love, there's only so much anything. And if anybody else got any, I got less. And so my job was to try to get credit for everything I could get credit for. And I found out that the basis to the love that changes us is anonymity. And I just began to cry. And Dan said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "You're great people. You're lovers." And he said, "You're one of us." And it changed forever the way I see myself. Nothing could have done that but you. You know, I went to meetings, and I went to meetings, and I went to meetings, and my life changed dramatically, rapidly. 6 months after I couldn't leave my apartment, I was studying with the world's greatest cytologist in Paris, France. And I said to him, I went to my sponsor, and this man invited me to come and study with him, and I went to my sponsor, and I said, "Dan, should I go?" And he said, "What do you think?" And I said, "I don't want to go if it'll endanger my sobriety." And he said, "Then it's okay to go." And we talked about things. And he said, "You know, some people like to use antabuse in tense times like this when they're new, and it might help them say no for one day." And we talked about whether we'd do that, and then on and on. And he said, "But you'll know." And you know, I was descending through the clouds into Orly Airport in France, and the sun was shining, and I knew that I was there. Because I was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. In January the 1st, 1974, I was walking the streets of Paris, welcoming in a new life. And I went to a meeting there, and I found people just like you from all over the world, and they just took me under their wings. And it was an incredible experience. And there's a man there named Charlie B. who still lives there, and Charlie's from Kentucky, and he moved there in 1946, and he's sober 20-some years now. And he was then sober about 4 years. And as God would have it, his house and studio was 2 blocks from where I was staying. And everybody else would sleep in the afternoon in Paris. And I couldn't even sleep at night, much less in the afternoon. So I go down to Charlie's studio, and Charlie detoxified drunks down there. And I'd sit there and feed these guys soup and tell them my story. And they didn't speak English and I didn't speak French. And I just feed them soup and tell them my story. And I'd wonder if maybe they didn't see in my eyes what I had seen in yours. And I think maybe they did because they seemed to react to me the way I had reacted to you. And it's been like a miracle. Like a miracle since then. Things have happened to me that can't happen to a human being. I was wondering, I couldn't sleep, and I used to run around town all night. I'd get in the car and I'd drive all around Washington, D.C. all night, and I'd go to all the monuments and everything. I had an old idea about policemen. I didn't like policemen. Policemen didn't like me. And I knew they were all alike, and I was running around this night, and just frantic. And if you don't sleep for a while, you can go crazy, and I'd be frantic. And I remember I went down and I rolled my sleeping bag out, or I went down and I lay down by the Jefferson Memorial one night, and I was just laying there looking at the stars, and I fell asleep. And I woke up, and I was thrilled. I knew what the problem was. But I couldn't sleep. I was trying to sleep in the wrong place, and I went up and I got my sleeping bag and I brought it down and I laid it out on the grass by the Jefferson Memorial, and I lay down and I was looking at the stars and I went to sleep. And a little while later I felt somebody kicking me and I looked up and it was a park policeman. He said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I'll tell you." And I told him. And he said, "No kidding." He said, "You mean you haven't had a drink for 50 days? And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "That's wonderful." And he said, "This is the only place you can sleep?" I said, "This is the only place I found it I can sleep." And he said, "Okay, buddy." He said, "I'll tell you what." He said, "Anytime you need to sleep, you come down here and sleep." And you know, and every few days I get my sleeping bag and I go down to Jefferson Memorial. And I roll it out, you know, and I'd be laying there looking at the stars and one of these guys would come by and they got to know me, you know, and they'd say, "Keith, is that you?" And I'd say, "Yeah." And they'd say, "How many days?" I'd say, 83 days. I said, "Isn't that wonderful?" And I said, "Would you like a cup of coffee?" I said, "No, I better get some rest." And they said, "Don't worry, we'll keep an eye on you." And, you know, I was wrong about the police. You know, I was in AA just a short time, and I was frantic about everything. Everything was a big deal, and I was always frantic, and I was always looking for problems. And I belonged to the Problem of the Month group, and always looking for problems. And the old-timers kept laughing. They had a good time with me. And they kept saying things like, "Easy does it. Let go and let go. Relax. You got plenty of time." And things like that. They didn't understand how serious this stuff was. And I had this old idea that for every problem, there's only one solution. Right? There's one answer for every problem. If you don't get the answer in time, you drink. You know, once you recognize a problem, the clock starts to tick. And then after, when the alarm goes off, a big hand comes down, pours a drink in your mouth, and you die. So every time I recognize a problem, I start running to these old bozos to get an answer. And you could rely on them, they'd give you an answer, but one day there was no answer. I ran to this guy and he said, "I don't know the answer to that." And I said, "But you always know the answer." "So I don't know the answer to that." He said, "But there's a man down at the Metropolis Club in D.C., I'll bet he'll know." So he gave me his name and I ran down to the Metropolis Club and I got there and I ran in and I had about an hour or 10 minutes to live and I asked for this guy and they said, "Well, he's out on a 12-step call." I said, "Well, I got to talk to him." And they said, "Well, he'll be back in a few minutes for the meeting." So he came back in, he's dragging some drunk with him and I ran over to him. I said, "I got to talk to you." And he said, "Well, after the meeting." I said, "I may not be alive after the meeting." He said, you'll be alive. He said, "Sit next to me. Nobody ever dies next to me." I said, "Okay." So I sat down next to him, and the meeting was over, and we went over in the corner, and it's a beautiful man, a black man, with white hair, and he said, "What's the problem, son?" And I said, and I began to tell, and I told him my problem. And he looked at me, and he shook his head. He said, "My," he said, "I've never run into a problem like that." He said, "I don't know the answer to that problem." And I said, "Well, you are my last hope." And he said, "Well, I'll tell you what." And I said, "What?" I said, "Anything." He said, "Don't drink. Even if your ass falls off." And I remember driving home thinking, that's the most profound thing I ever heard in my life. And what I realized that night was that this isn't about answers. This is about a solution. And you know, a week later, I forgot what the problem was. I don't know if I still have it or not. I may have it. I don't know. But I forget what it was, you know. And I had all these old ideas. I really didn't. And you know, one of the old ideas I had was about women. I had this old idea about women, and I didn't like women very much, and I didn't know I didn't, but I was afraid of them. You know, because they could make me feel so good or they could make me feel so bad. And I was really frightened about it. And I spent a lot of years in Alcoholics Anonymous acting on those old ideas. And I never got real close to women, And consequently, I never got to know women very well. And I just treated women in a very bad manner. I really did. And one day, I just couldn't take anymore. And it was another one of those crummy, lousy relationships, those selfish things where it's take, 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 and try to figure out exactly where 50-50 is and who was doing what to whom and all that nonsense. And I got on my knees one night and I began to pray. I was at a friend's house I'd moved from Birmingham. Well, I was visiting from Birmingham up to Washington, up to North Carolina, and I was at my friend Bob B's house, and I got up about 1 o'clock in the morning. I was just tormented by this latest relationship and the stuff I'd done, which was just plain wrong. And I got on my knees and I begged God to make me different. And I told him, I said, Father, I'll do whatever you tell me to do. I will go wherever you want me to go, and I'll serve you in any way you want me to serve you. But please, never ever let me hurt another human being like I have. And I'll do it single, and I'll do it without sex. But please, don't ever let me be what I've been. And I woke up on my knees that morning. I dozed off to sleep, and I woke up, I was still on my knees, and I got up, and I was different, And I didn't know how I'd be different. I was just different. I went off to a meeting, played golf that day, and then went off to a meeting that night. My friend Bob was speaking, and I didn't want to go to that particular group. But you know, when I was there, I met a woman. And I was able to treat her differently. I was able to be faithful in a relationship. I was able to put her needs first. I was able just to cherish her. And you know, we got married about 2 years ago. It's incredible. It's the most wonderful thing I ever met in my life. You know, I don't ever want anybody else. I just want her. And I just want to cherish her and to idolize her. I liked holding her close to me when her mom died about a year ago. And telling her that it was going to be okay. And you know, when my first wife's father died, I came in 2 o'clock in the morning, and she had been sitting there crying on that living room floor for 8 hours because I was out drunk. And now I was doing a workshop, and I got the call, and I just said to these people, I'm sorry, the person God put first in my life needs me. And they said, of course. And I got in a car, and I drove to her. I was just with her. You know, you stay away from Al-Anons, okay? Because they never let you win. You know, that day I was with her, you know, and I really was. And I was thanking God the whole time. And you know, at the very end, we were laying in bed and I was holding her. And I said to her, you think you can drift off to sleep? And she said, yes. And we said a few prayers together. And she nestled her shoulder into her head into my shoulder. And she exhaled. And then she said, oh my goodness. She said, I'm sorry. And I said, for what? And she said, I haven't thought about you. I know how much you love Mother, too. And nobody's thinking about you. And you know, I can't outgive. I just cannot outgive people like her and people like you. I can't do it. And so the next day I got up and tried harder. And the next day she outgave me. It's an incredible thing. And it's all because of people like you. I was wrong about women. I was wrong about Dumb Denny. You know, when I got to that seventh and eighth, or eighth and ninth step, I put Dumb Denny's name on the list. And I know what I owed an amends for. I really poisoned the atmosphere for Denny. Boy, when you got a brother like Denny who looks so good and does everything once, it's hard to live in a house like that. So I spent every chance I had putting him down. You know, I'd say, oh, it's too bad about Denny, and I'd drop whatever little dirt there was around. And that's what I owed him an amends for. I owed him amends because I envied him and I was afraid of him. And I drove from Washington to New Jersey, and his lovely wife, Jan, was there, and we began to talk. And she somehow knew something important was going on, and she excused herself and went off to bed. And I told Denny why I was there. I said, I love you. I said, you're my brother, and I love you. And I probably admire you more than any human being in the world. And I'm here because I owe you an amends. And I said, for the last 6 months, what I've done is anytime anybody says anything about you, or every chance I get, I say good things about you, and they're true. And the reason I did that is because, and I told him, and I said, because I've always been afraid, and he started to laugh, and I said, what's so funny? And he said, if you owe me an amends, then I owe you an amends. He said, all my life I've been afraid. He said, I was afraid to do anything wrong. He said, I was afraid to change majors. He says, afraid of making a mistake. And he said, I always envied you because I watched you and you never gave a shit about anything. He said, if you didn't like the country you were in, you went to another country. And he said, you came through a horribly difficult divorce. And he said, you went to Skid Row and you came back. And he said, I'd give anything if I could be like you. He said, I always admired you more than any human being in the world. And I realized that we weren't bad. We were different. And a difference is wonderful now. We get together and we play golf and we're good friends. It's terrific. And I was wrong about my brother Denny. I was wrong about religious people. You know, I put religious people on my 8-step list because I criticized you people who knew your relationship with God. I criticized you deeply. I was one of those people. There are a lot of us in AA. I was one of those religiously anti-religious people. You know? And you said, God, I told you about it, and I put you down, and if you did what the big book said and talked about God with unashamedly, then I'd let you know about it. And what I really was afraid. And I was afraid of religious people, because I knew you were a lot better than me. And I used to go to a retreat house, and I went down there looking for somebody to do an amends with, and it was a young theologian. I'd gone back and gotten a degree in theology and philosophy, and there was a young theologian down here who I knew he was hep, and he'd understand the significance of this terribly humble act I was about to perform. And I couldn't find him. He just wasn't around. And suddenly I kept going by this room, and there was an old man sitting in there, an old priest. His name was Jim. And he's sitting there, and he had a blanket over his lap, and he was reading his Bible. And I suddenly realized that's who I was supposed to talk to, and I knocked on a door. And he got up, and he said, come in, son. And I came in, and I sat in a rocking chair across from him, and we both sat there and walked. And I said, Father, I'm here to make amends to you and people like you. And I began to tell him why, and I began to tell him the names I called him and the stuff I said to him and about people like him and everything. And he was watching and rocking back and forth, and I knew he was dying of cancer. And I got about halfway through, and I was telling him about my alcoholism and what I'd done and everything. I got halfway through, and this saintly man put his blanket down, and he got up, and he put his arms around me, and he began to cry. And he began to pat me. And he said, son, please don't. He said, it's not you who owe me an amends. It's I who owe you one. He said, I've been a priest for 50 years, and he said, I've been praying to God to show me what it is I've missed. And he said, I realize now that for these last 50 years, too often I've forgotten what my higher power has told me. He told me to leave the 99 that I was comfortable with and who agreed with me and who appreciated me and go after the one that was lost. And he said, I'm sorry that you were out there alone. And I came to understand something about these steps. They aren't for me. They aren't to make me better. They're for the world. They are. It's to make a world in which I can live. And I left that room free. Free to allow you to worship God the way you want to worship God and to appreciate that. But mostly free for me to worship God the way I wanted to worship God. And I went to a friend of mine who's a prayer partner who's living in a house I own down on the ocean in North Carolina now. His name's Mike. And I went to Mike and I said, Mike, I have a hard time getting on my knees to pray. And he said, Keith, get on your face. And I was able to get on my face to pray. And now whenever pride's there and I don't have time to get on my knees or I don't have time to spend time with God, I get on my face. And that's where I'm most comfortable before God. You know, I've been wrong about everything. I was told that when I was new. An old timer, one of these old perverts and sadists, told me one time, I was running around dealing with a problem, working on a problem. I love that, work on a problem, you know. If it wasn't a problem before I began to work on it, it sure as hell was after I started. And as if I can do anything about a problem other than work the sixth and seventh step. I mean, you know. But at any rate, I was working on a problem, and he said, "Son," he said, "do me a favor." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "Borrow lipstick from one of the girls and go home and write on the mirror, 'Keith, you were wrong.'" And I said to him, "You don't seem to understand. My problem is I have a poor self-image. You see, I grew up in a crazy home, and I went on and on and on." And he said, "Look." I said, all right. And I wasn't going to borrow anything, basically, from a woman, so I went and bought a tube of lipstick. And I went home, and I wrote on my mirror, "Keith, you were wrong." And I threw it in a trash can, and I was really disgusted. And I went off, and it was a normal night. You know, I slept about 45 minutes. I tossed, I turned, my mind raced like crazy. All this stuff. And I got up the next morning, it was a normal morning. You know, I was depressed. First thought I had was, "You're never going to make it." The second thought was, "You're going to go to work today, and they're going to find out you don't know how to do the job you've been doing for 7 years." You know? Third thought was, "You're going to be alone for the rest of your life." Well, what the hell, you're impotent, what difference does it make? Just normal morning. And I went in, and I just wanted to die. And I went in, and I started a coffee, and I walked in the bathroom, and I looked, and it said, "Keith, you were wrong." I said, "Well, thank God, if I'm right, I'm in a hell of a lot of trouble." And I realized it's a great privilege of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous is being wrong. And the more things I can be wrong about, the better my life gets. You know, there may be a better way to live their life than this, but I don't know what it is. And there may be a luckier human being in the world than me, but I don't know who he or she is. I am truly the luckiest human being that ever lived. I moved to Fayetteville, North Carolina. I love Fayetteville. It's my home. I love, an ex-Marine, and I love the 82nd Airborne. And I love those guys who are over there right now doing what they're doing. And I love the flag. And I love being a citizen of a country, and I love belonging to a community. I love voting. I have a library card. I'm a real, honest-to-God citizen. I take part in everything that God's given me. And I love it. I play golf, and I go to halfway houses, and I get to go to a prison one day a week and talk to those guys. I just love everything God's given me. And He's given me more than I ever knew ever existed. But most of all, He gave me you. Without you, none of it works. Without you, I can't know God. Without you, I can't know serenity. Without you, I can't be honest. Without you, I can't have peace of mind. Without you, I can't have anything. It all hinges on you. And I owe you everything. And tomorrow, I'll owe you more. And that's the way this thing works. And I don't understand it. I just do it. You know, I moved to Fayetteville, and I was sitting out on a balcony over this little lake. And there were some ducks down there and stuff, and I was reading the big book, and I was reading the big book. I've come to love Scripture. And I again, was overwhelmed with gratitude, and I began to cry. And I said, "Why me, Father? You know, why have you picked me?" And I thought back to when I was in that treatment center. Then it was 8 years before, and I called this poor woman that I'd put through such torment and torture, and I'd been there about a week, and I really suddenly realized what the problem was. And I called her up, and I said, "It's me." And she said, "What do you want?" And I said, "I'm an alcoholic." And she said, "No kidding." And I said, "Why me?" And she said, "Why not you? If anybody deserves it, you do." And she hung up. And I was sitting there 8 years later saying, "Father, why me? Why have you picked me?" And He said, "Why not you, son? If anybody deserves it, you do. And it's not because of what I am. It's because of what He is and because of what you are. Of myself, I'm nothing. But when I'm with you, I'm everything that He ever wanted me to be." Thank you.